What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
We spent a great deal of time covering the impact of the second Trump administration on our most marginalized communities, mostly in regards to sweeping executive orders, robbing people of their humanity, civil liberties, and immigration protections. Today, we're going to continue that coverage with a conversation about the Trump administration's impact on children. We're joined by Eli Hager, a journalist who focuses on threats to federal social safety net programs, as well as systems that lower income families interact with at the state and local levels. Eli's latest article for ProPublica is "The Trump Administration's War on Children. The administration is quietly putting America's children at risk by cutting funds and manpower for investigating child abuse, enforcing child support payments, providing child care, and much more." Good morning, Eli. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Eli, before we walk through, like, I'm going to go, you know, sort of department, program to program, talk about a little bit more about why this part, right, the impact on children of Trump administration actions has mostly gone under the radar and not talked about.
I think for a few reasons. For one, children's programs and services are located across several agencies in the federal government, and a lot of these are little known, sort of anonymous agencies. So you have the Administration for Children and Families, which is within HHS, and even within that, you have the Office of Child Care and the Office of Child Support Services and the Office of Head Start. And then over at the Department of Justice, you have the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention. And obviously you have the Department of Education. So anyway, you have programs and services located across the government, and they're in these kind of smaller offices. And so they've gone overlooked amid all this kind of chaotic slashing across the federal government. And then I also just think that people don't realize how much the federal government does for children and children's services, from child support to child protective services to child care and so on.
The Department of Education has been a target of the Trump administration. I mean, that has been in the news, and maybe dismantled altogether if he has his way. Can you talk about some of the impacts that the DOE is already seeing?
Well, sure. I mean, obviously, the president is interested in shutting down the department altogether, which would have impacts in all 50 states and in school districts in all 50 states. But so far, one of the largest things that they've done is withdraw what had been pandemic recovery funding, about $3 billion worth, from states that were still spending it on things like tutoring for students who have fallen behind, improving school buildings to make them safer in the air, safer to breathe in the water, safer to drink, things like that. Projects that were already underway, that funding's been withdrawn, and that'll have concrete effects on children. And there's also obviously this threat that if that schools that rely on Title I schools that are tend to be in lower income areas could have their funding withdrawn if they don't meet the DEI orders of the Trump administration. So, and then obviously there's effects on student financial aid and so on, but I was more focused on K-12 students.
Eli, this actually wasn't in my question or in my script for today, but I want to just take a moment from your perch as someone who like sits in these issues day in and day out. What would a shuttering of the DOA potentially look like? Like, if you had a crystal ball and you saw into the future and this actually happens, what kind of catastrophes are we talking about here?
Well, at ProPublica, we have some reporters who are actually better suited to speak to the Department of Education. But with that being said, if the Department of Education were fully shuttered, state and local school districts, they would still exist. The federal government doesn't run the education system, but it does provide a lot of funding, especially to those Title I schools. So schools in lower income areas would greatly suffer in terms of their funding levels. I think a group of students that would particularly suffer would be students with disabilities, because the Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights and other programs try to make sure that students with disabilities have civil rights protections and that they have the resources that they need to get a good education.
And before we move on from the DOE, one of the other impacts is that, you know, the extension of COVID funds have been completely wiped out. Can you talk about the impact of that and how the Trump administration justified cutting those funds?
Yeah, I mean, like I mentioned, these are funds that the schools across the country were already using on all sorts of things, tutoring services, a lot of improvement of the physical facilities of schools, projects that were already underway. The Trump administration has said in rescinding all of that money that COVID is over, and that why should schools be allowed to spend this money on improvements when COVID is over, and if an individual project needs to be extended, that the school district will have to show exactly how COVID is connected to student learning. What it amounts to is a withdrawal of $3 billion of funds that schools were using to educate students and to improve their buildings.
Many of the programs that you're talking about in your article are under the banner of the Department of Health and Human Services, which has regional offices. Talk about what those regional offices are, how much territory they cover, and what impact of cuts have been on their staffing levels and capacity.
Yeah, it's a good question. The Administration for Children and Families, which is within the Department of Health and Human Services, kind of complicated to keep it all straight. That office has 10 regional offices, 5 out of 10 of which have now been closed or all the staff laid off at those offices. So that's over 20 states that now no longer have a regional office for children's services. And that's really important. I mean, Donald Trump a decade ago started promising that he would, drain the swamp in D.C. and start to spread the government out across the country. Well, this is the opposite of that. The effect that it'll have is that folks who run children's services, whether it's child support programs or child protective services agencies or child care providers, when they need help in their specific region, they don't have somebody to go to anymore other than kind of political appointees back in D.C. And so these regional offices, what they had done is developed relationships with these local providers of children's services and helped them, including county and tribal child support offices, for example. Some tribes didn't have child support systems, but these regional offices would help them set up child support systems and provide data and training and technical assistance. Now the tribal leaders and county officials won't have anybody to go to when they have problems with their child support system, unless they can reach somebody in DC. So it was basically how local children's services interacted with the federal government at the local level. And they won't have that anymore.
We've been talking a lot on the show locally about what's happening to Head Start, right? Because we know across the country, cities, states, budgets are devastating to the point that you make in your article. A lot of times the first back that folks try to balance budgets on is that of children. Can you talk about Head Start and how federal cuts have impacted these programs and what further devastation is on the horizon and how soon we can expect it?
Yeah, Head Start is probably the most imminently at risk of all of these programs. We've already seen some Head Start locations have to close because they haven't been able to access their funding. So there's a couple of things that are happening. For one, the kind of looming on the horizon is that the president's budget proposes to eliminate the Head Start program altogether. So that there's a Head Start program in every community in the country. People in rural areas especially depend on Head Start because often the Head Start program is the only child care location in a whole rural town. And so if Head Start were fully ended, that would leave 1 million working parents across the country without anywhere to send their kids during the day. But even just like as we speak, Head Start program directors are having trouble accessing the funds that they're already supposed to have. So when they've paid their teachers or bought school supplies, and then they try to get reimbursed using their existing funding, they're being redirected to a DOGE website that asks them to justify the spending that they've already been, their spending's already been approved and audited, but they're being asked by DOGE to justify it. And so they're having trouble accessing it, and some are having to shut down. And then some might not get their grants renewed on May 1st or June 1st or July 1st. They're done on an annual basis. So we might see more Head Start programs start to close in succession in the coming months.
I mentioned earlier, and you mentioned in the article about, like, this isn't, you know, the first time that government agencies have tried to balance budgets on the backs of children's services. Can you give us a historical perspective, like, when cuts like this or have cuts this massive been threatened or happened before, or what happened, and what was the impact on the health and welfare of children and families?
Well, often the reason why cutting children's services, even though children are sympathetic in kind of a general sense, but the reason why cutting children's services is more politically viable is because, you know, they're not voters and they don't belong to political organizations. Usually, although there are some organizations like students who are fighting gun violence in schools and so on, but they don't have the kind of outsized impact on the political process that, say, older voters have. The AARP has a lot of impact on potential cuts to Social Security and lobbying against that. But there isn't kind of like a voting constituency of children, so it's easier to cut those programs. And we've seen that a couple of times throughout recent history. It came up during the welfare, quote unquote, welfare reform efforts of 1996 under the Bill Clinton administration. Some of those programs ended up negatively affecting children, and it was pointed out at the time that when push comes to shove, children are probably going to be the ones that are thrown under the bus when there are choices to be made between different groups of people who are potentially harmed by a program. And again, with the attempted repeal of Obamacare, or the repeated attempted appeals of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, it was overwhelmingly children who relied on Medicaid who would have been harmed by that repeal. So it's just it tends to be easier for lawmakers to pull that off.
Can you talk a little bit about the willingness or unwillingness of the people that you spoke to identify themselves out of fear of retribution?
Yeah, I mean, that's been true. That's not just on this issue. That's been true across our reporting at ProPublica. But, you know, because people are seeing what's happening to universities and students and law firms and lawyers and journalists themselves and all kinds of targeted groups, that they're a little bit more reticent about speaking up about the potential harm that they're facing because they don't want to be targeted for that harm. And so, for example, some of these programs that investigate missing children's cases and that investigate violence against children and internet crimes against children, some of them didn't want to speak on their record because they think they could still get a grant from the federal government, even though those grants have been suspended by the Trump administration, which we go into in the article. They didn't want to talk about the potential harm of that on their record because they're hoping that they can still get the grant and they don't want to be targeted.
Did any of the folks that you talked to paint their own picture of what they feared the ripple effect of this moment will be in the future?
Certainly. I mean, across the board, this is a series of programs. And again, they're across several different agencies. Some of these offices aren't very well known, but they serve thousands of state and local children's services agencies across the country at the county level and nonprofits and so on. And so this ripple effect of these small federal offices will be quite vast if they continue to be slashed. Already we've seen, again, 5 out of 10 regions of the Administration for Children and Families cut entirely, as well as a lot of the support staff and system staff who you know, like run the help run federal child support databases and things like that. So you could see things like child support system failures, child support not making it to families, child care programs having safety issues because they're not being monitored, all kinds of ripple effects that we'll see over the coming months without these public servants doing there to do their jobs anymore.
All right, Eli, we've got to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks, I appreciate it.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.